right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our show today is going to be quite an interesting one. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking to Deborah Sweet about the movie Zero Dark Thirty. We were scheduled, for people who saw the publicity for this, we were scheduled to have Glenn Greenwald, but unfortunately, Glenn was not able to make it at the last minute. So Deborah has kindly agreed to step in and basically talk with us about the film. And that should be a very, very interesting segment. It's a very necessary segment because too many people are falling for the okey-doke on this, and it's worse than the okey-doke. Complacency and conciliating equals complicity, and we got to talk about that. But opening the show up is someone who's a frequent guest on the show, and he is someone who has, constantly been talking with him a lot over the last year around the question of mass incarceration, around police brutality. His name is Carl Dix. He's a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's one of the founders, with Cornel West and a number of other people, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he recently wrote a piece in Revolution newspaper that police attacks on Black and Latino youth are multiplying. He said, this must end, and we must end it. So we're going to be talking with Carl about that. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Good to hear your voice, man. Okay. Now you're supposed to say it's good to hear your voice too, Michael. Okay. Anyway, your article, a very, very compelling piece, a very troubling piece, and there's a lot to talk about in this. You talk about that the police murder of Black and Latino youth, that the situation facing Black and Latino youth at the hands of the police, murder and assault, have multiplied tremendously. What is the situation right now?
I mean, the situation is you look all across the country and you see situations where police literally murder people. You know, Joel Aceveda, Manuel Diaz, on back-to-back days, July 21st and 22nd in Anaheim. Both of them are gunned down. This year began Romarley Graham in the Bronx. The cops follow him to his house, break into the house, chase him up to the bathroom, and shoot him while his grandmother and six-year-old brother watch. Trayvon Martin is killed by a vigilante, and we get the Florida Stand Your Ground law, which then comes back in the killing of Jordan Davis. And all the way in between, just horrific instances where police have treated people like they're less than human, that their lives don't matter, that they've been blown away, run over by police cars, shot in the head while handcuffed in the back seat of the car after being double searched, and then the police say, oh, he must have shot himself. This is going down, and it's going down with no talk of penalties, punishment for these murdering cops. And we have to say, no, this is unacceptable, it's intolerable, and it can't go down like that. We have to stand up and fight it. And we also have to link it to the whole thing that's going down, because law enforcement in general has been unleashed as part of enmeshing Black and Latino youth and older Blacks and Latinos as well in the criminal justice system. In and out of jail has to become a rite of passage for Black and Latino youth. That's also unacceptable, and it's all part of racially targeted mass incarceration.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit deeper. You mentioned the point about that, you know, this stuff gets, you know, all too often no one is, you know, punished for any of this, that it's occurring at just an amazing rate. If you step back and think about it, I was thinking about it the other day when the Stolen Lives book came out back in the mid-90s, there was a question of thousands of people. And now you think about how many times out that has been multiplied, you know, the people who have been killed by the police. And to me, each and every one of these things, outright murder. And you look at it, and including, you know, the people, the cops in Anaheim, what happens to them? Not much. Or you look at the, you know, the fact that Zimmerman and the racist that shot Jordan Davis about the, you know, their whole thing is, it's the Stand Your Ground law, that which gives them the right to basically gives them the right to attack and kill Black people because they felt threatened. Or you look at something like, just recently Kendrick McDade out here in Pasadena. The investigating attorneys or whatever part of the city, the Pasadena city, decided that, okay, the DA, I guess it was, decided that, okay, it was justified. It was all justified. And the most disgusting. And just, it was one of these Oscar Grant type things. And yet there hasn't been the kind of uproar that needed to happen around this. They chased, I can't remember whether it was the sheriffs or the LAPD, but at any rate, they chased a number of people. They stopped them. They arrested them. One kid got away with handcuffs. He was handcuffed. His hands were cuffed behind his back. He ran away. At some point, got down on the ground and crawled under a car. When the cops found him, they pulled him out by his feet, and they shot him. And they said he was reaching for a gun. It only came out much later, after the police report was filed saying he was reaching for a gun. Then it came out that we forgot to say his hands were cuffed behind his back, and he was laying face down on the ground, and they pulled him out by his feet. You know, and all of this stuff goes away. And I think too often people will look at this and say, well, it's an anomaly. It's not really the way policing is. It's a complete and utter anomaly. We have to get the cops to be good, to do what they're supposed to do and not be rogue killers.
Yeah, well, the problem is that this is what the police do. You know, because there's this line of, well, there's only a few bad cops. Well, when you actually look at the situations, like going back a bit, the police murder of Anthony Baez, when a cop named Lavoti choked him to death. Well, there were 14 cops on the scene. One of them chokes a guy to death, and then 13 of them meet at the police station to concoct a story to cover up and justify this murder, and only one of the cops refused to be part of that meeting. And that cop ended up being hounded off the force for not being a team player. You know, and that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a police force that has police forces all across the country that have some people who are just cold and naked, brutal killers. And then most of the rest of the cops stand with them and help, are complicit in this activity by helping to cover it up and justify it. And that's part of how they get to the justifiable homicide from situations that are down and outright cold-blooded murder.
But isn't it more, I mean, you made this point about this is what the cops do. And, you know, it's true that there's like, you know, there are these cold-blooded killers in there, but it seems like there's an attitude that the relationship between the cops and the people, there's automatically an attitude of the cops and the people enemies. You know, and on the top, and anything that you have to do to suppress, to oppress, to keep the people in their place is justifiable. Because if you don't go for them, they're going to go for you, especially Black and Latino youth. They're all killers. They're madmen, all of this stuff. That seems to play a big part in when we're talking about what the cops do, because the cops have a social role. It's not just that they recruit psychopaths, you know?
Yeah, well, they recruit, train, and then reward and punish in relation to driving people to be part of suppressing sections of society that they hate and fear. Because just to step back a bit, we're talking about a system that's dealing with a big problem. Because you got all these people in the inner cities all across the country where jobs and legitimate opportunities to, you know, work, support yourself, raise a family have been sucked out. They got no future for these youth, and what they've responded with is criminalization, treating the youth like they're guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. But this is a question of the police force being the frontline enforcers for a capitalist system that has that approach to people. And when you look at it, you've got the racial profiling, the police brutality, and the murder that happens in inner cities all across the country and even beyond the inner cities. Then you have the pipeline into prison and mass incarceration that has made it literally a rite of passage for Black and Latino youth. You go in and out of prison. That's what the life is like for people, Blacks and Latinos all across the country. Then even once you get out, you're discriminated against. You can't find work because you've been in prison. You're not allowed to get a government loan and try to go back to school. You can't even live in public housing. They don't even let you vote. When you put all that together, you've got tens of millions of people, because there's 2 million plus people in prison, 5 million people on parole or probation. Then you add in their loved ones, their families and loved ones. You've got tens of millions of people whose lives are literally enmeshed in the criminal justice system. And I talk about this as mass incarceration being a slow genocide that's grinding along and breaking the bodies and crushing the spirit of Black and Latino youth especially. And this is something that people have to stand up and stop. There's a slogan, mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. And it expresses the reality, but there's another part I need to add to that. It's time to break the silence.
Well, we'll get into that in a minute, because I actually do want to pursue that as we go along. But I think first I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the situation, how much the assault and murder of Black and Latino people and the driving into prison, the whole thing, the whole slow genocide that Carl's just starting to talk about, how that's all multiplied and intensified over the last year, and particularly in a situation where everything seems to be coming to a head in that kind of oppression. Carl, I wanted to talk about this a little bit deeper, this point about how this murder, you know, relates to the other facets of the police assault on Black and Latino people. How this police murder, this wanton murder, this terrorizing of Black communities relates to these other facets. You know, how does it back it up? What impact does it have? And because I kept thinking about, you know, something that you've been very involved in, Stop and Frisk. And the point about Stop and Frisk, and it gets this thing where there used to be this thing about driving while Black, you know, that was a common way that the cops, if you were Black and driving a car, you could almost count on being, you know, stopped and sometimes killed or shot or beaten up or whatever. But the basic point is that there's an element of profiling that really seems to back up and normalize all this.
Yeah, and that's exactly the case. And here in New York, they have made it an official policy. You mentioned it, Stop and Frisk. And under that policy, the police stop people for any reason or no reason at all, question them, and search them, frisk them, you know, pat them down, make them turn out their pockets. And under this policy last year, they stopped and frisked 680,000-plus people in New York City. 85% of the people they stopped were Black or Latino, and about 90% of them, they couldn't even find any way to implicate them in wrongdoing. They couldn't even write them a ticket for jaywalking or littering. So what they did is they stopped, jacked up, and frisked more than 600,000 people who were doing nothing wrong. And sometimes they told them to go on their way. Sometimes they smacked them up, beat them up, especially if people ask, why are you doing this to me or don't I have rights? That's 2,000 people each and every day. You know, that's what was going down. And it really is part of treating a whole generation of people like they're criminals. And even some of the people who ended up getting arrested or otherwise violated by the police, many of them had been doing nothing wrong because they had a policy. In New York State, it is not illegal to carry a small amount of marijuana as long as you don't display it in public. And one thing that happened a lot here in New York is that they would stop and frisk people and make them turn out their pockets. If you had that small amount of marijuana that was legal in your pocket, if you displayed it in public, then you had committed a crime and you got arrested. And marijuana arrests skyrocketed in New York City in relation to stop and frisk, and it was overwhelmingly Blacks and Latinos. Out of 50,000 marijuana arrests in New York City over the past few years, 90% of them, 45,000 of them, were Black or Latino. So it's all part of criminalizing this generation of Black and Latino youth and setting up a thing where it's part of setting up the rite of passage that I talked about. You kind of get the feeling you're young, you're Black or Latino, you kind of expect to be hassled by the police. People would get stopped dozens of times in the space of a year going to and from work. And you just begin to feel, well, that's the way it is. I guess I just got to take it. I don't like it. But that's how it is. You know, people going in and out of prison, it's just something that's going to happen. And we need to, and part of the reason that I joined with Cornell to initiate the campaign against Stop and Frisk and to form the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is that we needed to bring forward the kind of resistance that could basically say to people, no, we don't have to take this. This is intolerable, it's illegitimate, it's unjust, and we can and must do something about it. And that was an important development, and it's something that we have plans to keep going into 2013. We got some big plans for a Black History Month.
All right, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that in a couple minutes. I have a couple more questions, man. You keep wanting to rush ahead.
No, you got questions.
Well, let me remind people that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Now, Carl, the stuff that you've been talking about the profiling and the criminalization, the thing that I keep thinking about is you've been talking about genocide for quite some time. You've been talking about the slow genocide that can make a quick leap to a fast genocide. You know, and this whole idea, this whole, you know, the one thing about genocide, when you go through all the various things that are generally considered necessary to be in place or seen, identified as being in place on the way to genocide, this idea of dehumanizing, of profiling and dehumanizing a whole sections of people as, you know, inhuman, as animals, as dangerous, and isolating them off and doing all this other stuff, it seems that there's a really troubling and a very dangerous tie-in between all that's going on with the wanton murder, the normalization, the acceptance of this, the fact that people aren't out in their millions demanding that, you know, something when Trayvon Martin happens or Jordan Davis happens or the situation in Anaheim happens or whatever, when or Marley Graham, any of these people, when it happens, that people aren't, no, this is not acceptable, you know, ends up being contributing to this normalization, and it seems to me is greasing the skids for the slip into quick genocide.
Yeah, it definitely is, and that's part of why Cornell and I felt that we needed something that would break that silence, would reach out to people and say, there's a way that we can take this on. We don't have to take it. Because you're right, I mean, genocide is a process. A lot of people look at genocide and say, oh, yeah, that was what they did to the Jews in Europe during World War II when they carted them off to the camps and massacred them. But see, actually, the process of genocide began well before that, with identification, with separation, with dehumanization that you talked about. And all of those are things that are going on right now, targeting especially Black and Latino youth. And you can't wait till it's time to be carted off to the camps to say, okay, now we got to rise up. Right now, what's going down is illegitimate, intolerable, and unacceptable, and people need to stand up and do something about it. I mean, because if this is the best they can do around law enforcement and safety, they just need to get out of the way, because this could be handled much better. And if the power was in the hands of the people, if we were in a revolutionary society, we would have law enforcement that would sooner risk or lose its own life than harm or kill an innocent person. But that's not something that's possible in the context of this system. Its drive for profit in the hands of a few and its need to subjugate and exploit people here and all around the world.
I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Now, that's a contentious question. That's a contentious statement, though. There are many people who would say it is, in fact, possible if you just exercise the right kind of pressure or you get the right kind of authorities in power. Why do you say it's not possible to have a different kind of policing in this kind of society?
Look, I've been involved in this question of law enforcement, police brutality, police murder for decades. I've seen and been part of mobilizing people to stand up. And what you get back in relation to this is at times some reforms that actually keep together the basic thrust of protecting and keeping in effect and extending this system and the way that it works. That's what it comes down to. And you look back over the decades, the slow genocide that I'm talking about is rooted in the sucking away of the legitimate ways to survive in these communities, and there being large numbers of people that they had no future for. And their approach to that was, we got to clamp down on that. See, and when that's what's actually going on, when you step back, you're not going to get a different kind of policing, because they have to do something about this section of people that they got no future for and whose response they fear. They remember the 1960s when Black people stood up against what was being done to them back then and how it sparked and brought forth a broader revolutionary movement that rocked the system back on its heels. They don't want to see that happen again, And criminalization is moving in advance of something like that. The criminalization comes down to counterinsurgency before the insurgency, trying to get people caught up and enmeshed in the law enforcement, the criminal injustice system, ground up, beat down, so that they're not in position to rise up and do anything about what's going on. And we really have to work from the other end to get people to stand up, to say this is unacceptable, and to wage determined resistance. And you do that, it delivers two messages to different sections of society. One message being to those who are suffering it, that this isn't an individual problem. You're not alone in it. It's a social problem, and it requires a broad social response. And then the other message is that when you stand up and fight back, others in society who are sheltered from what's going down with you, in many cases unaware, can be one to come and stand with you in this fight. And we've seen that in the struggle around stop and frisk and mass incarceration, where some of the people who stood up were people and were part of fighting stop and frisk were people who had been stopped and frisked and were tired of it. But there was also students from Columbia who came out with us, professors, religious people, people who were not themselves targeted by this but did not want to live in a society where this was the way that people were being treated simply because of the color of their skin. And that's an important thing in terms of breaking the silence and making 2013 a year of rising resistance and determined mass struggle and, you know, actually fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution, which is something that, as a revolutionary communist, that's how I'm approaching this and taking it up.
All right, well, let me ask you this, and then I want to get into your plans and a bigger question about the state of resistance right now. But let me ask you this, since you brought this up, and it follows off of the question of, is it possible to have a different kind of policing? But first, let me remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Now, Carl, you talk about getting a new society. You know, and a lot of people might say, well, okay, that'd be fine. That's all well and good. But, you know, you really, there are going to be things, you know, you're not going to be able to turn people into, not everybody is going to be, you know, Johnny Good Do Good, you know? And there's like, there are people who will have different kind of things going on. There'll be, you know, will there be police, for instance, to deal with some of the contradictions that arise in this new society? Which I know you would say there will be contradictions of various kinds and different natures and content of the contradictions, but will there be police, and what will the difference be?
Well, yeah, you're going to need people who handle law enforcement. But here's the difference. It would be a society where power is in the hands of the people, where the economic relations in society are working to meet people's needs, not to put profit in the hands of a small minority of rich and powerful people. And also working to transform the situation to the point where nobody is in relations of exploitation, nobody is being suppressed or degraded because of the color of their skin, because they're female or, you know, lesbian, gay, or bisexual. Those social relations are gone. And the backward ideas that go along with them are being fought throughout the society. And in that case, the role of law enforcement won't be to suppress people and hold them down so that they could be exploited and robbed by the rich and powerful in the system. It would be to facilitate those developments, you know, and it would come into situations and rely on the people to handle them, because time after time you even see situations today where the police are called in because somebody's in trouble, and then they come in and brutalize and even murder people and take it over and not let the police, not let the masses be involved in it. And I've seen a number of situations where that goes down, and law enforcement in a revolutionary society would go at a thing of, let's rely on the people who could come in and help resolve this situation, you know, whether it was somebody who was having mental distress, had physical problems, whether it was contradictions among the people. The point wouldn't be to come in, suppress, decide who to brutalize or brutalize everybody, which is often the case, but to actually rely on and work with the people to resolve those contradictions. And this is possible if you're in a society where there isn't a need to suppress whole sections of people. There isn't no longer the society is working in the interest of a handful of rich, powerful people, the capitalist class, whose wealth and power depends upon exploiting the great majority of society, and in the U.S., exploiting the great majority of people around the world. So this is possible. It is not a pipe dream, but it would take a revolution to bring it about. And we talk about that new society in a draft constitution for a future socialist republic in North America. And I encourage people to check that out, and I'll give the website that they can get to it in a minute.
Okay, well, before you do that, let's talk about this, the state of resistance right now, because it seems to me we're in a pretty terrible bind here. We've got a situation where things are developing faster than I think anyone really even can grasp at a certain point, than a lot of people can really grasp, how quickly things are rolling down the hill here. And the idea, what's your assessment of where is the resistance? What's the state of resistance to all this now, and what are your plans?
Well, the state of resistance is overall far too low, you know, and if it's not transformed, then we do continue the trajectory, you know, the genocidal trajectory, and it could speed up, and, you know, we could get so far that it would be impossible to do anything about it. But within that overall too low resistance, there have been things that point to the potential to break through on that, the hunger strike that the prisoners engaged in out in California, and the support work that was done around it pointed to what could be different. The campaign around Stop and Frisk here in New York that Cornell and I initiated, the way that people responded and stepped into the streets around Troy Davis's legal assassination, you know, when they executed him in prison. So there's potential. Some of the ways that families like the family of Romali Graham have stepped forward to fight for justice, not only for their murdered loved one, but for all of the victims. And what has to happen is that has to be built on and accelerated. We have to find ways to enlist broader numbers of people in a movement against this slow genocide. That's what we've been working on in the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And it's why we did blow the whistle on Stop and Frisk and mass incarceration overall last September, because whistles were a way to enlist broader sections of people in the resistance. Well, we have to build on that, continue that, and we're going to launch, as part of building on that, we're going to launch a project that we call Bear Witness, which will gather stories of people who have been abused by law enforcement, whether that's a question of torture-like conditions in prison, whether that's a question of being brutalized and abused by the police on the street, the stop and frisk, police brutality, police murder, and the discrimination against the formerly incarcerated after they've served their sentences. We're going to collect these stories and make them accessible and way out in society, so that it can begin to impact this thing of people who don't know, people whose eyes have been shielded from that. We're going to open their eyes to it, but also people who have been hit with this and who feel like it's almost the way things are and you just have to go with it, will begin to see that there's a different way to go at it. And then we're going to punctuate, this is going to be launched February 1st, and then we're going to punctuate it with a week of action at the end of February. And anybody who wants to find out more about this and get involved, they should go to the website www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's Stop Mass Incarceration, all one word. And get with us, be a part of planning this, because we're going to make Black History Month 2013 a month of struggle all across the country.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, let me give one more website, because I talked about the draft constitution.
Go ahead.
It's available at www.revcom.us.
And that is the website for Revolution Newspaper, where you can read Carl's articles and many other things that people should be reading and thinking about.
Read the whole paper, because there's a lot of real good stuff in it.
Exactly. All right, Carl, thank you very much. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we've been talking about the epidemic of police murder of Black and Latino youth in this country and how it's part of a whole genocidal push going on right now, and a genocidal push that needs to be opposed by everyone of conscience. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Deborah Sweet, the national director of the World Can't Wait organization, about the film Zero Dark Thirty. Yep, that's right, Zero Dark Thirty. Yikes! We're going to talk about the film and why you should be deeply concerned about it. So stay tuned.
No more lies. But try. Devil's emotion caught in the act. In the name of freedom, they stabbed us in the back. Before the eyes of God, with a wink and a nod, they tell us how we're on the right track.
Don't you feel our freedom slipping away? It's getting harder and harder to believe a word they say.
Trying to keep us in our place.
We've been here forever.
It's time we all join the human race.
We're all in this together.
Anything else is a disgrace. Oh,
we ought to know better.
Puppets in all right, show. Welcome back. That's Ivan Neville and Dumpster Funk with Ought to Know Better. And I felt that that was extremely appropriate for the entire show today. Just a great song and a lot to think about in that. Ought to Know Better. Think about that one, okay? Now, as the award season, the movie award season is set to begin, take a guess which film is being heralded as a shoe-in for numerous Best Picture awards and has already received a boatload of awards. It's Zero Dark Thirty, a movie that follows in the grand tradition of Leni Riefenstahl, the Nazi filmmaker whose most famous work is a glorification of Hitler and the Nazi Reich, Triumph of the Will. Catherine Bigelow's previous film, Hurt Locker, attempted to evoke sympathy, and Catherine Bigelow is the director of Zero Dark Thirty. Her previous film, Hurt Locker, attempted to evoke sympathy for the U.S. soldiers terrorizing and murdering the Iraqi people. Now, with massive assistance, unprecedented in modern history, from the U.S. military and the CIA, Bigelow has created a film that glorifies torture and the CIA, and it turns the world completely upside down. Joining us to talk about all that is Deborah Sweet, who is the National Director of World Can't Wait. Deborah, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure. So there, I set you up. Start talking, sister. What's so big about this film? Why is it such a big deal?
Well, you've hit on some of the points. This is the CIA's view of the world. The unprecedented access includes extensive time that the writer and the producer and the director spent with the CIA in particular, and I would assume with the Navy SEALs as well, because they're portrayed as incredibly buff, heroic figures at the end of the film. This is a film that completely turns reality upside down, in my opinion. You look at what happened in New York, and I was sitting in the theater Wednesday with 100 people in New York City, downtown, you know, where they never let us forget about 9/11, and, you know, there's justification for that. It was very traumatic. It was a very terrible day, carried out, as far as we know, by incredibly reactionary forces. Nothing good about them. It was a horror, and there were 3,000 people killed. This is how the film opens. But everything that the U.S. has done since then has proven to be more of a horror, actually. And we can run down the effects on people in a large swath of the world from the U.S. so-called war on terror, and what that has meant for hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq, for displacement of millions of people from that country, the setup of black sites, and the movie, you know, of course, you've seen it, I think, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
The movie takes us around right from the beginning to various black sites, which we still don't know the full locations of. In Poland, I think we go to Afghanistan. We certainly go to some in Thailand. We bounce around from U.S. secret base to U.S. secret base where men are being tortured. I lost count at about 10 people in this film who were being tortured in the name of all of us. I mean, this was being done in the name of getting vengeance, of keeping everyone safe, of doing all these things we were told was necessary to prevent something worse from happening. And then again, I would assert it's the war on terror that has been the biggest horror to the people of the world. And this movie does nothing but glorify that.
Well, let's dig into this. Let me remind people we're talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the film Zero Dark Thirty. Now, Deborah, one of the things, I mean, look, one of the things I was really troubled by when I sat in that film is I was troubled by, one, how glued people were to the film, you know, and I'm watching it. And the first 45 minutes, it seems, is just, it's true. It's not just the numbers of people, but the intensity of the torture and the constant putting you right into the middle of it. And the watching of the people being tortured are nefarious thugs. Even when they're beaten to a pulp, they still, you know, you're looking at them and there's this undercurrent of these are sneaky, lying bastards. And they're not going to, you know, they can't, you know. There's nothing at all that's, you know, redemptive about them. And that yet the torturers are nice people who cry over their monkeys being killed, or who first might blanch at some of the things they're asked to do, but then get into it and do it. And you're looking at this and this whole normalization of torture. It really, one, it just, you know, it was stunning in a very bad sense. And it was at the same time really caused a lot of concern for me that people were sitting there and there wasn't like people getting up and saying, what, this is nonsense. This is, you know, it wasn't that kind of thing going on. And I was really troubled by this whole portrayal of the torture and tortures as it's, you know, this is the way things are. The U.S. has to do this in a deep, dark world.
Mm-hmm. You know, Glenn Greenwald, who I think was originally going to be your guest.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad to be able to fill in when he wasn't available. But I learned some things from what he wrote about it, and one of the important things I think he pointed out is that all the violence in this film, except for the violence of the torture at the beginning and then the raid on Abbottabad at the end, in this film was carried out by Muslims, by Muslim men, and they were painted in their entirety, maybe except for a few characters who aren't really named, that Muslims are the ones who are doing the violence. And in fact, there's this cry from some CIA station chief in Pakistan, I think, who says, you know, they hit us in 98, they hit us in 2000, they killed 3,000 of our people, you know, and they're massacring our frontline troops. And he's yelling at all the other CIA agents that they better bring him some bodies so he can kill them. Bring me some people so I can kill them.
Just to, you know,
I'm just read news. Yeah. I mean, this is real. And, you know, Greenwald's point is the poor, harassed CIA, we are the good guys. We're suffering through this. I just read the cover story in Newsweek, Daniel Kladman, who says, you know, this is a story about America's finest hour. What was America's finest hour? Well, you know, in his opinion, it was getting Osama bin Laden. And yet, you're spending 10 years and you're seeing this flash in front of you, country after country, people held with no rights. And the spitting irony of this in terms of this huge access that the filmmakers had to the CIA and the military is that we, and I'm speaking broadly, and also those of us who have been protesting and working very hard to stop torture, Over the last 11 years since Guantanamo opened, particularly since the scandal in Abu Ghraib, since learning about the black sites, since knowing that rendition continues when the Obama administration took power, that's the secret rendition policy where the U.S. can grab anyone anywhere, since the National Defense Authorization Act was passed a year ago, giving the president the right to sign an order to seize anyone, anywhere, at any time, hold them without rights, hold them without a lawyer, even kill them through a targeted assassination. All of this is what's come in the wake of this one incident, we are told, and that the U.S. can never stop because it has to keep us safe. Mm-hmm. People in the world are not safe because of this. And I think this is why I feel it's so important for people. You know, I'm not telling people to boycott the movie. Mm-hmm. I think people should go see it and see this is what a liberal Hollywood studio has produced. There was a big glitterati party. I don't know if that's the right term. Monday night here in New York where these actors who, you know, I think in other times have taken really good positions on things against wars and so forth. We're toasting it up for this movie. Now, some of them said they hadn't seen it. But Jessica Chastain, the premier actress who plays the CIA agent named Maya, who, if we're to believe the film, never has done anything in her life since high school but look for Osama bin Laden, is put forward as, number one, an amazing actress in the film. And then she says things like she has a great deal of compassion after doing this film. For who? The people tortured? No, the actress Jessica Chastain says she has a great deal of compassion for the CIA agents who gave up their whole lives for this fight and they never get the recognition they need.
Just
this
incredible.
This is why I'm saying this is turning reality on its head. You've got to grapple with it.
Yeah. We're talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the film Zero Dark Thirty. Well, let's talk about this point here because it's one of the things I wanted to get into with you. You know, there's this whole point that's being made is, come on, it's film, it's art, it's, you know, let's deal with that. It's technically really spellbinding and it's, you know, it just moves you along and it really does what a good film should do. I can't count the number of reviewers who at one point I think you would have considered very progressive who are writing and just waxing ecstatic about this film, about how great it is, what a tremendous piece of art. And it really does, you know, Jane Meyer raised that in an article she had in the New Yorker where she said, you know, what is happening here? Torture has become morally acceptable entertainment and people are praising this as high art, as the, you know, the best that the film industry can produce in the year 2012. You know, what the hell is going on here?
Well, I mean, I will say the guy who played the number one torturer, I thought he was really adept at playing a torturer.
Yeah.
I mean, it was chilling. Here he is, a pretty hip guy. I was really hit by all these special forces guys. Now, I know it's Hollywood, but these guys were, you know, in good shape. They were joking around. They had a lot of confidence, but they weren't the stereotypical U.S. jock or the stereotypical grunt soldier. They were very sophisticated. They were talking about foreign policy in the language that the system talks about it. They were obviously very highly trained. And yes, I feel the same way you did. I could not possibly have felt that was entertainment. I have viewed a lot of the actual documentaries about all of these issues, like Alex Gibney's film Taxi to the Dark Side, which came out fairly early on about the torture going on by the U.S. at Bagram Air Force Base in 2002 and 3, where we know they killed people. They killed named people, including the guy in this film. That was a spellbinding, dramatic film, very high production values. Hardly anybody saw it. Why? It didn't get the backup, and it certainly was produced in opposition to and with the opposition of the very forces that were building the torture regime across the world, not just in this country, not just in Guantanamo, but across the world in places we're not even allowed yet to know about. All the access these filmmakers got to these classified records, they won't give the people. We cannot find out where those secret prisons were. But these filmmakers who are going to shill for this killing system, they get the access. That should tell you a lot right there. And that's why I feel people need to go out and protest this film. To add insult to injury, it opens on Friday, January 11th, 2013, which is, not coincidentally, the 11th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. illegal prison in Guantanamo.
We're talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the film Zero Dark Thirty. Think about this. When you're saying that, even in the film, remember the line in the film where it says, where they're arguing about what they can do, and a guy, and one of them says, "Look, we've had, you know, we've had our butt in a sling ever since Guantanamo, and we've had it since Abu Ghraib. You know, they're zeroing in on what we can and can't do." And then they talk about, well, how are we going to prove any of the intelligence we find now? Because what are we going to do? Go to Guantanamo where these guys are all lawyered up and they'll just, you know, whatever. I mean, it's like, that's the kind of thing that's going on. And you have this, in relation to this, you have this situation where what a lot of people are referring to as embedded filmmakers, you know, where you actually have these filmmakers who are have embedded in, dependent upon, and willfully taking up this whole, the whole view of the system and the U.S. imperialists and the war, and what they're doing in the world, their view of the world. This is a very disturbing factor, and it does remind me of the Leni Riefenstahl thing about the, you know, look, I'm just doing art, and I created this homage to the Nazis, you know? And
I think it's an apt comparison. I don't disagree with you at all. And the fact, again, that this is the Hollywood liberal elite with very high production values, it's going to be seen by millions or tens of millions of people, certainly around the world. And if we're not in those theaters, outside, inside, I don't care. Whatever your creative imagination and your dramatic sense tells you is necessary and possible, I think we have to be challenging people watching this film with the reality that this is our government, in our name, responsible for killing hundreds of thousands.
You know, it's
allegedly, because 3,000 people were killed in this country.
Right. You know, it's interesting when you were talking about what's revealed to the filmmakers and what's not revealed to the people. There's actually something that happened just recently in terms of the military tribunals that are beginning, and the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And what was going on with his trial, where the government decided that they, in fact, are not, they're going to refuse to allow any testimony detailing the torture that this man faced. The 183 times that he was waterboarded is now not relevant to his trial. This is the kind of stuff that's coming out around this. It's like, it's, you know, you think about this, and again, something that World Can't Wait has always been marked by, which has been the idea that, to, you know, basically struggling with people, that conciliation and complacency does come down to complicity. And in a sense, it's something Glenn Greenwald raised in some of the stuff that he's written about, too, where he said, look, the love for this film is not separate from its political content, and it's not being so well received in spite of its content, but because of it. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, it's just absolutely essential that people look at what is being put forward as a work of art. And yes, it is a work of art. It's going to serve people's understanding of reality or not. And in this case, it massively serves and is done by the people who are in bed with this system, as you put it very well. It's absolutely incumbent upon us to raise our voices about and to point out all the details by which this is wrong. A lot has been made by people, you know, even within the government, I believe, who, you know, like John McCain put out a statement the other day saying torture is wrong, and there ought to be some acknowledgement by the filmmakers that the final verdict is that torture was not what enabled the government to, you know, have this horrific, really, if you're in the middle of it like that film puts you, raid on the human beings that were living in that home, including the children, the women, people who were killed. You just cannot sit back from that and accept that as number one reality. You've got to look at all the layers that went into it. And I really think that in the big picture, you know, when history speaks, these people must and should be found to be war criminals, and the people who are aiding and abetting that do bear some responsibility.
Yeah.
But then we're going to be out raising our voices against it.
We're talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the film Zero Dark Thirty. Well, let's talk about that. What are you going to be doing?
Well, for one thing, you know, World Can't Wait got known very early on in 2005 when we began for marching around in orange jumpsuits, and that's even taken on more importance because now you're looking at the explosion, if you will, of orange jumpsuits in this country because they're used domestically to massively incarcerate people. But the orange jumpsuits were used in Guantanamo for the what they called the most recalcitrant prisoners. And we adopted that as a form of protest of Guantanamo and indefinite detention. And we're going to bring them back, you know, theaters in as many places as we can, Friday night, January 11th, inside, outside. We have a flyer that people can download at worldcan'twait.net. We're producing as much as we can about this in terms of reviews and people writing and thinking about it, talking with people. And I think we will continue to refine this. Of course, we're going to be at the U.S. Supreme Court that day as well, protesting that it's the 11th anniversary of Guantanamo. Still 166 men there. Most of them were cleared for release up to 10 years ago. A lot of them are from Yemen. The reason they can't be released, because the U.S. doesn't want them to go back to Yemen. This is even that little few square miles of the Guantanamo prison camp is filled with all the contradictions that the U.S. has on its hands from Guantanamo and this regime of torture that, you know, in my opinion, it will never get away from. And there are those here and around the world who will not rest until there is significant investigation and prosecution of the people responsible for it. And yet for that ever to be effective, we're going to have to significantly counter what's being done in films like this.
Well, let me ask you one last question.
I'd like to see people look at all these other films, too, and we'll have a list on our website where you can really get the truth of what happened.
And your website is real quick.
It's worldcan'twait.net.
Okay, and let me ask you one quick question. We got about a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes. We got 2 minutes that you can answer this in. You know, a lot of the terms that are being set around how the struggle around torture around this film, how to assess this film is getting carried out, is the idea that one, either they're lying about the efficacy of torture in getting information that's needed, or that, you know, the question is, does torture work or doesn't work? And that, to me, seems cannot be allowed to remain or to be even be out there as the standard that we're operating in, the terms that we're operating within. What would you say to that?
Well, no government, no matter who they are, is ever justified in carrying out torture. It's not the kind of society we want to live in ever in the future, and especially now. But what a government does is reflective of its values. And in this case, the values expressed by the Obama administration now, and you can go back a couple of hundred years, is that other people's lives have no value compared to American lives. And then within the country itself, there are certainly people whose lives have no value. This is a vicious, class-based, predatory system, and torture is embedded in the system. I think we have to keep that in mind. And we have to look very deeply and right in the face of all of this. That's why I think people, if they can stand it, should go watch this film. There's some truth in there about what happened. The contention is over how that gets summed up.
Exactly.
Yes, they did do all those things and worse. Yes, we have to stop it.
Exactly. All right, Deborah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, man.
Okay, take care. Talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of The World Can't Wait, and we've been talking about Zero Dark Thirty, a poisonous, poisonous film that's out there today, and the need for people to, you know, stand up and speak out about this. This is just crazy that this kind of thing is allowed to be the normal state of affairs. Okay, and before we go out, I want to read you a couple of quotes from Bob Avakian's book, Basics. The first one is, American lives are not more important than other people's lives. I think that's very, very appropriate given our last topic of discussion, as is this quote. If you can conceive of a world without America, without everything America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggles to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything less? Again, that's both from Bob Avakian's book, Basics. All right, that brings us to the end of another show. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guests today, Carl Dix and Deborah Sweet. I want to thank my board op today, Federico Garcia, and my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that is dedicated to all those people who, for one reason or another, believed that the world was going to end on December 21st. Well, here we are, and here's the song from Elvis Costello, Waiting for the End of the World. Check it out.
Later.